Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great today, David. I'm doing great.
So two big, interesting stories in the news. We want to see if we can draw some connections between them. The first is a story in the Indian Ocean in which a U.S. missionary, John Allen Chow, tried to bring the word of Christ to a group of indigenous people who didn't take very kindly to visiting their island, and shot him with a bunch of arrows. And the other story, which at first glance doesn't appear to be all that connected, but we're going to see if we can connect the dots, is a showdown at the U.S. border at Tijuana, in which the caravan that the president has been complaining about has reached the border, and the president for a brief period of time shut down the border, and over just a few days ago, the U.S. Border guards fired tear gas into, I guess, into Mexico, actually, to try to repress or send back migrants that were pushing up against the border. So, Frank, before we get into the sort of history of borders and missionaries, do you have anything you want to add to those two really kind of troubling news stories on troubling, I guess, in different ways, but
Well, I mean, I think the reason we've linked them are in part is because of the media and social media responses to them. I mean, I think in both cases we see individuals crossing borders or attempting to cross borders and meeting with resistance. And I guess that's the kind of commonality. I think that there was a great deal of sympathy for Mr. Chow and his unfortunate experience in North Sentinel Island in the Indian Ocean, despite the fact that he was violating Indian law in going to this island in order to spread the gospel. And we saw in Tijuana that some persons were actually not breaking the law. Asking for asylum is not a violation of the law. In fact, it's legal in both international and U.S. law.
In fact, the U.S. border guards are the ones violating the law by not recognizing their claims to asylum. But that's, yeah.
But anyway, we'll get to that, I'm sure. But I guess there are issues of boundaries and borders and laws and what's legal and illegal in both these stories, which is why I think we're linking them, although they're, you know, thousands and thousands of miles apart. I also think what we see in, you know, this is a podcast that we do as historians of the United States. This, you know, there are American dimensions to both of them in the case of the missionary who was killed in the Indian Ocean. He was an American attempting to cross the border, and people responded in a certain way to that, particularly in the United States. Whereas in Tijuana, what we saw were Central Americans attempting to cross the Mexican-U.S. border to enter the United States. And so there are kind of – the differences are also instructive, which is why
And I guess that the political difference, you know, in terms of the responses to these things, if we're going to sort of be over general, you know, with the case with the missionary in the Indian Ocean, the – people on the right seem to sympathize with the missionary, and people on the left tended to think that he shouldn't have been trying to go to this island because he was endangering the lives of the indigenous people with disease and whatnot. Whereas with the question on the Mexican border, the political position seems in some ways to be flipped. The people in favor of the people trying to transgress the border tend to be more on the left, and the people who are much more about maintaining firm borders seem to be on the right.
That's right.
So it's an interesting sort of question here about borders and who's allowed to cross borders and what's a legitimate justification for either restricting the movement of people or violating those kinds of restrictions.
That's right. I mean, this may appear to be a rather unfair and reductionist description of the circumstance, but what seems to have happened in the last week is that if you're a white American Christian attempting to cross the border in the name of spreading the word of God, that's okay, even if it's violating the law. Whereas if you are a Latin American woman with children trying to cross the U.S. border seeking asylum, that's not okay.
Yeah, at least that's the Fox News version.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So let's think about these kinds of borders and sort of delineations. Going back to your time period, Frank, what kind of borders did people recognize? What was considered? What were the lines that were important, and how well regulated were they?
Well, there were notional boundaries, I suppose, in the colonial period in North America and elsewhere. But what we see, if you look at some of the so-called charter boundaries, because the mainland colonies in North America, at least those established by the English later British state, were all mostly established by charters issued by the crown. And those charters are very, very vague as to boundaries because the awareness of North American geography, certainly in England in the 17th century, was severely limited. And so when you see some maps that have the kind of charter boundaries projected across North America, where, you know, the boundary of South Carolina will extend to the Pacific Ocean, the western boundary, and they're fairly absurd. And to some extent, those notional boundaries are going to remain very, very important for over a century. Having said that, imperialism and colonization and settlement was all about settling land and subdividing land, and most importantly, commodifying land and selling it. So, you know, land surveyors are incredibly important in the colonial period because they're dividing land up so it can be bought and sold and settled. And of course, that comes at the expense of indigenous peoples. But we don't really get proper boundaries until, and by proper I'm using, again, listeners, I'm using inverted commas here, until the
which Americans call quotation marks, Frank.
Thanks, David. we don't really get proper borders and boundaries until the era of the American Revolution, in part because the newly independent states have to literally delineate their boundaries, but also the new United States in international law has to have boundaries. And so we see a precursor of this in 1763, which with the so-called Proclamation Act, when George III attempted to separate the settlement, white settlers from Native Americans along the Appalachian Trail. But the real kind of forming of the boundary that becomes important, I suppose, is in 1783 with the Peace of Paris and in the American War of Independence, which stipulates that the western border of the United States will be the Mississippi River. The northern border is a bit amorphous, and we'll probably talk about that. It's more or less the Great Lakes, but it's not entirely well defined. And the southern border is really the Gulf Coast of modern Florida and the Gulf Coast of Mississippi and Alabama. And so borders are created by international relations, essentially, I think.
But in terms of efforts to create a border, I think that the proclamation of 1763 is an interesting case. Because, I mean, this happens at the end of the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War. George III says, great, we're going to not have conflict with Native peoples because we're going to draw a line basically along the Appalachian Mountains, and no one's allowed to settle west of that. And so there is sort of a line on a map in London that sort of delineates the space and says this is for one set of people and this is for another set of people. But then the question is, well, how do you regulate that? Did George III do anything to try to regulate that border?
Well, I would slightly disagree with that characterization. I mean, that's the textbook version, but
I know. So you're the expert in this century, Frank.
To some extent, it's more a case of, I mean, yes, that is what happened, but it wasn't intended to necessarily to be a permanent border. I mean, there was a conflict between Native Americans and settlers that broke out, that persisted after the official end of the Seven Years' War. And so in an effort to impose a peace, at least a temporary peace, George III issued this proclamation, and there's a notional border. The army is there theoretically to enforce it, and the British army, that is, and to keep the settlers and Native Americans separate. But I think there was a belief, and I think that certainly in London, and there was definitely a belief among the colonists, that this wasn't going to be a permanent arrangement, that this was simply kind of, this was temporary until peace could be restored. So it's a notional. I think it's more a boundary, if we can draw a distinction between a boundary and a border. I don't think it was meant to be a fixed border, you know, forevermore. But it is an attempt to impose order from afar. And to, you're right. They draw a line on a map. Basically, the Appalachian Mountains are the boundaries between the settled part of the colonies and what would be Indian territory, at least as far as George III and his government were concerned. But I don't think it was intended to be a permanent border between the two.
And the other one from that sort of roughly that same time period that, that jumps out at me as being a famous border, or at least one that students often ask about, is the Mason-Dixon line, which I guess grows out of that, that sort of conflict that you mentioned earlier about where colonial charters, you know, draw these maps on a line, gives different territories, sovereignty over, or at least claim to various land, and those things weren't always coherent with each other.
Yeah, because colonial America is a mess when it comes to boundaries and borders, and
because their cartography is lousy too.
Well, their cartography is lousy, or they're sending out, or they're just establishing, they're acquiring cartographic knowledge as they settle, and they have to sort out competing boundary disputes between different colonies. And so the Mason-Dixon line is actually between Pennsylvania and Maryland. And it takes on great symbolic importance later because of the difference between North and South and slave and free and so on. So to some extent, that assumes greater significance after the fact than it does at the time. It's one of a number of surveying expeditions that occur during the late colonial period to basically to try and impose some order on what appears to be a disordered landscape. But we don't really get modern borders as we think of them until much later. I mean, the boundaries of North America, of the various nation states that make up North America, and here I'm thinking mainly of British North America, later Canada, the United States, and the Mexican Republic, are pretty flexible during much of the 19th century, as you well know. It's not just that the United States expands into space, but the boundaries are pretty porous.
Well, but they're also porous, but they're at the same time, you know, contentious. And, you know, the most famous example of this is you know, in 1846, when the Mexican War breaks out. That's not really how it happens. The Mexican War happens because the United States, the border between the United States and Mexico after Texas is annexed is in dispute. And Mexico claims it's one river and the United States claims it's another river. And the United States puts its army between the two rivers. And when the U.S. Army comes into contact with them, with some Mexican soldiers, you know, Polk says, look, we've got American blood shed on American soil. But it's only American soil if you buy the American version of where the border is.
Well, that's
If you buy the Mexican version of where the border is, this is an invasion that's already happened that Mexico is defending against. And one of, you know, Abraham Lincoln's first really only meaningful actions when he's in Congress in the 1840s is to try to call President Polk on this, you know, question of where the border is.
Well, and even before that, of course, you know, Jefferson's great achievement as president is Louisiana Purchase. And the borders of Louisiana were totally ill-defined and amorphous. They knew the eastern border of Louisiana was the Mississippi River. They had no idea where it was in the Southwest. When most of that territory was Spanish territory, it frankly didn't matter. And the United States asserted, and the Jefferson administration asserted, you know, they made grand claims for a lot of Texas. I mean, they gave those claims up. But they said, oh, yeah, this is all part of Louisiana, of the Louisiana Territory. The Louisiana Territory, even before the 1840s and what you've just described, you know, there are similar claims. And basically, the states in question always make the grandest claims to benefit themselves, which is totally unsurprising, I suppose. The United States is not the only expansionist state. All three of the states that now comprise North America made land claims at the expense of their neighbors.
And at expense of the native peoples who actually live on most of this land when they make their making their initial claims.
Indeed.
You know, it's when we get into the 19th century, I think, that we really start to see this idea of American missionaries sort of rising to the fore. I guess there might I tend to associate that with the Second Great Awakening as sort of being the birth of American missionary activity.
Yeah.
Is there stuff before that that I'm forgetting about, Frank?
Sure. I mean, I think to some extent, if we've just had Thanksgiving, if we buy the New England version of American history, the Pilgrim Fathers, so-called, were, among other things, missionaries. And there was a lot of missionary activity, and a lot of the justification for the early colonial settlements in the 17th century, those people who came with those ill-defined charters, in part, their settlement was justified because they were going to bring Christianity to the Indians. And there is considerable activity in that area that goes on in the 17th and 18th centuries. You know, Dartmouth College has its foundation as a school for Indians, for example. And so there are colonial efforts at missionary activity. There's also, you mentioned the Second Great Awakening. Well, the First Great Awakening in the middle of the 18th century was a religious revival movement. It's, as you know, quite different from the second one. But part of that was missionary activity, although that tended to be more missionary activity aimed at by colonists at other colonists. I mean, native peoples and enslaved people were kind of brought into it, but a lot of the activity was, so if you will, it was missionary activity. It was proselytizing activity by Protestants aimed at other colonists to a large extent.
I guess the thing I would think that changes really with the Second Great Awakening really is the degree to which people are choosing to go not only sort of beyond their neighbor, beyond their community, even beyond the native peoples who happen to be adjacent to them, but trying to go somewhere far away to convert people to your faith. As you know, the mission being something that is inherently foreign, and I guess obviously the stuff with praying towns and King Philip and stuff in the 18th century or sorry in the 17th century I think is similar to this, but I think there's a slightly different task when you embed yourself in a radically different kind of community that I associate with the Second Great Awakening.
Right, but hold on there. I mean, I think you're right. I like that definition. But to some extent, you know, Roger Williams leaving Massachusetts and going to live among the Narragansett Indians in what's now Rhode Island seems to be exactly what you're describing.
And that's true.
In the 1630s. Yeah. And there are, I think in the 17th century, especially in the North, we see several examples of what would fit the definition you just made of missionary activity. So I think this goes back earlier than the 19th century. I think what we see in the 19th century, not only in the United States, but in the wider world, is, we see this certainly in the British Empire, is missionary activity, which is, as you described it, people going elsewhere, someplace foreign, in part in service to the state or the empire they represent, but also to achieve this larger civilizing mission. And I'm definitely using inverted commas, come quotation marks, to say that, and spreading Christianity, also doing so in service to a larger, if you will, more secular mission of imperial expansion.
Yeah, I think that's, I think an important point that the Second Great Awakening really is a, it's a transatlantic phenomenon, and that there's often political components to it. The political sort of missionary that comes to mind with the Second Great Awakening for me is Peter Parker, not the Spider-Man Parker.
The Amazing Spider-Man.
Yes, no, I was thinking of the doctor from Massachusetts who goes to China, who unfortunately later gets given – anyway – he becomes really the first American missionary to China in the 1830s. He opens up a hospital there, but he's also very much involved in, sort of expanding Western medical treatment in China, spreading Christianity in China, but also serving as a agent of the U.S. government, representing, their interests in China. So, you know, when the United States opens up an embassy in China, he becomes, you know, works as a interpreter for them. He helps negotiate a treaty with China at one point. And I think it's one of the places where you can see somebody going to a radically different culture to try to spread Christianity, and often having this sort of humanitarian mission going along with it. I think that would have been fairly common during the Second Great Awakening.
But also, David, if I can say, I mean, that's a really good example. I really like the detail you provided there. Acquiring knowledge of the culture they're living in, which then becomes useful to their own the state they're representing. So they often act as cultural mediators, or missionaries will often play that role. And again, there's a longer history of that. I mean, one thinks of the Jesuits in New France and beyond, who, you know, to use contemporary parlance, embedded themselves among native peoples, acquired languages, and became really important cultural brokers, whilst all at the same time serving, if you will, imperialist ends.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you can trace a lot of the modern missionary activity, you know, in various ways to the Second Great Awakening. So whether that's, you know, various kinds of evangelical Christianity, Methodist, Baptists, Presbyterians, you know, engaging in foreign missions. I've got lots of relatives who are doing that kind of stuff. But also probably one of the most successful missionary religious innovations of the Second Great Awakening, the Mormon Church, you know, very much ties itself from the very beginning to missionary activity. And I think today on a global scale, they're one of the most, you know, committed American religious practices in terms of their overseas presence.
You know, certainly see him in Edinburgh all the time.
I think we both pass. There's usually a pair or sometimes two pairs of Mormon missionaries that pass us every day on our way to work, which, you know, is places to be posted. Edinburgh seems like not a bad gig.
Well, I always say to them, because the Mormons are renowned for their language abilities because of their missionary work. So I usually, when I often chat with them on the meadows, I say, oh, so you guys are really bad at languages, right? So they sent you here, and they. They often laugh.
But the interesting thing about Mormon missionaries in terms of their theology is it goes very far, you know, according to the Mormon version of this. You know, the first Mormon mission is Samuel Smith, Joseph Smith's younger brother, who starts missionary activity in 1830. So, as soon as the Book of Mormon comes out, the Mormons are sending out missionaries, at least in their own tradition. And Brigham Young is actually one of the people that Samuel Smith converts. But they start also to send missionaries into native communities, and obviously there's a relationship with Mormon theology there, where, you know, they have a very particular understanding of native history, and they want to go and try to convert native peoples. But by 1837, the Mormons are sending missionaries to the UK. By the 1850s, they're sending them really around the world to South America, to all over Europe, you know. And so from the very beginning, Mormonism attaches itself to having this sort of global vision of what, you know, their religion could be. And the thing that strikes me about this is that this, you know, thinking about what the Mormon Church is going through in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, you know, this is a time when the Mormons are receiving an enormous amount of persecution within the United States. They're in Ohio, and they get driven out of Ohio, and they go a variety of places. They end up in, you know, Illinois, and then they get driven out of Illinois, and Joseph Smith gets killed, and they go all the way out to, you know, Salt Lake City. So on the one hand, they are persecuted, they are insular, they're, you know, forming their own communities in Nauvoo and other places. But at the same time, they're sending people out into the rest of the world, and not just their neighbors, but to the far-flung reaches of the globe to try to convert people. I think that's an interesting dichotomy that, you know, that's really at the heart of sort of the Mormon worldview.
There is a book about to come out about this by a former student of ours named Ben Park, and I don't know whether you know Ben.
I know him online. I've not met him in person, I don't think.
But, Ben is a fabulous guy, a very, very smart guy.
And a very snappy dresser.
he's an extremely snappy dresser. Ben did a master's with us in Edinburgh. Then he went on and did his PhD at Cambridge. And he's now at Sam Houston State University, I think, in Houston.
That sounds right, yes.
And Ben is writing what will be a blockbuster book on Nauvoo and the early history of Mormonism, and I'm really looking forward to it. And Ben's a very smart guy. If you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. But he's got a lot to say about this and many other things. He's a very, very he's a brilliant historian, frankly. Yeah. So that's exciting. I think, and I think that dichotomy you put your finger on is very interesting, David. Let me, as you were talking, a question occurred to me. Is there a qualitative difference between the Mormon missionaries we might encounter on the meadows, you know, walking to work in Edinburgh, Scotland, and John Allen Chow going to North Sentinel Island? He wasn't a Mormon, I want to make that clear, but he's an American Christian missionary who was intending to spread the gospel to North Sentinel Island and got himself killed in so doing. I am not suggesting for a moment that anybody should kill any Mormon missionaries in Edinburgh, quite the contrary, but is there a difference between that activity? How would you distinguish between those two types of activity, or would you?
So I would distinguish between them in a couple of ways. One is the danger that John Allen Chow posed to the residents of the North Sentinel Islands. It has nothing to do with the religion. The danger he posed was biological. His arrival there could have killed all of them, simply because of they've been isolated for millennia, so they don't have the kinds of immunities and stuff. So, you know, he posed an existential threat to their way of life, and they have indicated very clearly that they, don't want outsiders there. They've shot arrows at helicopters and things. I think the Indian government wisely has decided that the best thing for them is to prohibit people from visiting the island for all of these reasons. For not only for the safety of the people on the island, but also for people visiting, because they tend to shoot arrows at people. The difference, I think, in Edinburgh is a cosmopolitan, multicultural city with a constant exchange of ideas and, Mormons can try to convert people and people can try to convert the Mormons into something else. You know, that we have a sort of the equal playing field. I tend to personally not, be a great fan of missionary activity, because I don't really like to be sold things, especially when I'm walking to work. So I sort of think about them in much the same way as the people who are handing out flyers during the fringe to shows I don't want to see. But I think those are qualitatively different situations. What's your thought?
No, I think you're right. I think there's I would agree with everything you've said. I think the biological circumstances are really, really important. I mean, we know from the early history of the Americas, of the encounter between Europeans and the indigenous Americas, how deadly what are known as virgin soil epidemics can be. And so Mr. Chow represented a kind of threat to that community, which is far greater than I don't believe that Mormon missionaries in Edinburgh pose any danger to the community. So I think I think I agree with you. I think that's a fundamental difference. I think there is, I think the fact that, the India has prohibited outside visitors to these islands, so they're protected by law in order to preserve and protect the culture of the people on North Sentinel Island is also important. And, there's freedom of religion in the United Kingdom. You can come and say what you want in an attempt to proselytize people if you don't pose a danger to them. And I think the circumstances are very different. Although I think the missionary impulse that characterizes not all of American culture, but parts of American religious culture are common between the two. And I think that is an important commonality, not unique, I would say, to the United States, although it's a prominent theme in American religious thinking, because the British have been missionaries all over the world, and there are other other missionary peoples, but this is a pronounced characteristic among certain forms of American religion in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the other sort of time periods in which I think there's an explosion in missionary activity coming out of the United States is the 1950s. You know, one of the things you start to see for the Mormons, for instance, is they actually start to ramp up and encourage Mormon young people to engage in mission activities, the sort of regular phenomenon of, you know, 18 to 20 year old Mormons going into being trained and then going on being sent around the world. You know, that really starts in the 50s and then grows even more in the 1970s as a phenomenon. But you still see a growth in evangelical missionary activities in the 50s. And I think that has to do with a couple of factors. One, obviously, is transportation. The ability to travel around the world is easier. But also, there's a way in which American consumerism and American ideas about advertising fit very neatly into the kinds of activities that missionaries are doing. About here, I'm trying to sell you Coca-Cola and I'm trying to sell you Christianity. And there's ways in which those two things go and sell you American democracy, and there's ways in which that those fit neatly in a 20th century Cold War context.
Sure, yeah, and I think I the last bit you said, I think the Cold War is all important as well, because the United States saw itself and set itself in opposition to so-called godless communism, and so democracy with God, if you will, was the antithesis of that. And so that was part of what the United States was selling. But you're right, this is at a moment when the selling of stuff became industrialized, if you will, in the United States. And so religion became another commodity to export and sell. But it did so in that ideological context of communism. The struggle against communism, I should say. What's interesting, of course, is we've also seen an influx, not necessarily missionary activity, but evangelical activity. A lot of this has returned to the United States. This might be a link to the other part of our discussion today, via immigration. So we've seen a growth of migration from the global south to the global north, including the United States in recent decades. Mm-hmm. But often those migrants from the global south, from Latin America, from sub-Saharan Africa, are bringing evangelical Christianity with them, which yes. had previously been brought to those regions by missionaries, but they're bringing it back. And so a lot of proselytizing and evangelism, both in Europe and in the United States at the moment, is being carried out by, if you will, the successors to those, or the spiritual progeny of those missionaries from a century ago.
And so you'll find, Korean Baptist and Methodist churches in the South that are, descended from missionaries that were sent from the South into, Korea, and then have come, and they're just, people have come back. And so there's a interesting sort of boomerang effect sort of thing happening. At the same time that this sort of growth of missionary activity is happening, though, the U.S. is, I think, the idea of borders and the idea of restrictions on borders in the 20th century, I think, is something that is really becomes much more enhanced. The kind of porous, fluid borders of the 19th century, as problematic as those are, I think really become much harder in the 20th century. And I think that sort of ties into sort of this movement of people that we've been talking about.
And also that ideological struggle during the Cold War as well, sure. and the militarization of American life and the advances in technology that make enforcing borders possible. In the 19th century, these borders were important, as you indicated. Justification of the Mexican War was a border dispute, but they were slightly amorphous, and frankly, they were unenforceable. Another friend of the pod, Lawrence Hatter, who's at Washington State University, has written a really interesting book called Citizens of Convenience, which I think I've mentioned before, which looks at the U.S.-Canadian border in the early 19th century. And basically, people cross it all the time, and they adopt whatever citizenship basically is in their financial interest.
Sure.
That stops in the 20th century. That's no longer possible.
I mean, one of the things that, thinking about, you said it was undefendable or unregulatable. There's nobody even trying to regulate these borders in the 19th century. There isn't a border patrol of any meaningful kind until the 20th century. The Commerce Department sets up something in 1904. But they have a grand total of 75 people to protect both borders.
Huh.
Not 75,000 people, 75 people. And they're, you know, they're part of the commerce border. They're much more interested in the idea of what material is crossing the border, who's trying to smuggle things and who's trying to avoid you know, customs duties and whatnot. When the border, border patrol is established in 1924, they open up two offices. They open up one in El Paso and then one in Detroit. Which do you think is the larger office?
I think this is a trick question, and I bet it's Detroit, because Detroit is the one American city where if you go south, you get into Canada, right? So it was,
yes.
Windsor, Ontario is just south of Detroit.
That's good.
And 1924, prohibition's going on, so they're worried about whiskey coming in from those nefarious Canadians.
Ding, ding, ding. You get it right. Okay, good, Frank. It's the, I had the trick question, and he manages to nimbly to cope with it. Excellent.
Those who know me know that nimble is often the adjective used to describe me.
But I think that's telling that really, you know, when the Border Patrol is thinking about the border, they're thinking about stuff. They're not thinking about people. You know, if you were to walk across the Mexican border or the Canadian border, as long as you're not carrying alcohol and as long as you're not, a Chinese immigrant who's trying to be smuggled in violation of the Chinese Exclusion Act, they don't really care. And so these are, in some ways, fairly porous borders. But one of the things I think you do find over the course of the 20th century is these porous borders become increasingly, you know, less porous. And there's a couple, I think, sort of turning points. One is in the Second World War, in which defending the borders becomes obviously a slightly bigger concern. The Border Patrol gets moved from the Commerce Department to the Justice Department then, which I think is interesting in terms of thinking about what the role of the Border Patrol is. So it's not about regulating commerce. It's about regulating criminal behavior. But then I think, the next sort of quantum level jump in regulating the border really happens first, I guess, in the 1980s, in which there's substantial increase in the number of people as in part of the Customs and Border Patrol. But then especially after September 11th, in which I think the whole idea of the border is really dealt with in new ways, in which the Homeland Security as a government agency is established in 2003. You've got the Customs and Border Patrol, you've got various other agencies, ICE, involving in securing the border, and securing the border not only at the border, but at depth beyond the border. I think Customs and Border Patrol claims everything within 100 miles of the border is part of their jurisdiction, which if you look at a map of the United States is like most of the people of the United States are within 100 miles of the border, if you include the coastline as part of a border. So it's a really extensive definition of what the border is. But the border has become, I think, increasingly militarized, especially since September 11th. There's something on the order of 45,000 Customs and Border Patrol agents alone, plus, I guess now with Trump sending, 5,000 soldiers?
5,000, yeah.
5,000, plus state police of various kinds and local law enforcement. There's been an effort to try to both militarize the border, and obviously there's the quest to build the wall that Trump has been engaged in since his election.
Right. Well, I think this is part of a broader trend, which we've seen, which is the kind of militarization of law enforcement again since 9/11. So, local police now are outfitted like soldiers or paramilitaries in a lot of cases. So
yes.
I guess it's not surprising, though we might find it disturbing to see that happening in terms of border enforcement as well. One thing that to just go back a couple of minutes, David, that I reflected on while you were speaking is it's interesting the obsession or the, as you put it, it doesn't matter if a person's crossing the border as long as they don't have alcohol. Prohibition, of course, is a product of the religious fervor of the 19th century. It's a legacy of the Second Great Awakening. It all kind of ties together with this question of borders and missionary activity in a kind of oblique way, I think. But you're right. The hard border, if you will, and the enforcement of the border is a relatively recent thing. I think we need to acknowledge, however, that President Trump is on to a political winner when he makes the border the issue, because that does respond, I think, especially with his base, but not only with his base. I think there is a when he says if a country that has no borders is no country, I think that message really resonates with people in a way. I mean, like many of his statements, it doesn't actually make sense, but it resonates in a way that some of his other messages do not.
Well, but at the same time, you have the Trump administration defending the rights of American missionaries to travel abroad, violating national borders. There was the case of a missionary, an American missionary, that ended up in a Turkish prison, Andrew Brunson, that the Trump administration helped to get out. And one of the things that was said in the when the Trump administration was successful in getting this missionary out of a foreign prison was Senator Richard Burr, who's one of my senators from North Carolina. He said that really that the missionary's work is fundamental to what it is to be American, and so there's this effort to sort of firm up American borders, but at the same time delineate that foreign borders should be permeable by American Christian interests. So it's an interesting sort of dichotomy that they're trying to weave there.
Well, we're back to the very beginning of this podcast with the, so John Alling Chow's unfortunate death is seen, at least by some, as kind of heroic and tragic, whereas the attempts by people, refugees from Central America to find asylum in the United States is illegal and must be stopped. I mean, there's a kind of inherent contradiction there that runs, that both links these stories but also runs through them, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we will see how the crisis at the border resolves itself, because I'm watching that situation very closely, because it looks like, if anything, it's going to only intensify over the days and weeks to come.
Well, and as I said, sorry, I know we need to move on. I think in part, I mean, this is a crisis entirely ginned up by the Trump administration, but I think they think they're onto a winner when this happens, notwithstanding the kind of widespread global outrage and horror at some of the images we saw on Sunday about, women and children being tear gassed. Yeah. But I think they think they're onto a winner. So I agree with you. I suspect it will get worse because they don't mind those images.
Those images horror me. I think people have this misconception that tear gas is somehow innocuous. It's not. Tear gas can blind you. It can kill you. It can burn you. It's, especially for the children and the elderly, it can be deadly. And, I was horrified by those images. And as somebody who's thought and written some about refugees professionally, it just, I'm at a loss for words. Let's go to Frost Drops, Frank, and let's do something slightly more cheery. What do you got?
Well, speaking of borders, we have a job at the University of Edinburgh in history. The closing date is coming up on December 6th. So if you're interested, please have a look at the further particulars or contact David or myself. It's a job in the Indigenous History of the Americas, broadly defined. So we are looking for a historian of the Indigenous Americas, working basically in any period or any place.
So North America, South America, Caribbean, the whole thing, Indigenous Americas, borderlands.
That's right.
Any century.
And we want to get the best possible candidate, and we want the best possible list of candidates. So please apply if that's your area of interest, or tell your friends who are Indigenous historians to apply. And the closing date is coming up. It's on December 6th. For those of you unfamiliar with the British system of jobs, academic job searches, it will move very quickly. We're looking to interview at the end of January and to make an appointment soon thereafter. Tell your friends.
Yes. Americans listening, this is not the slow roll of the American job market. This is a much speedier process.
Yeah. What do you have, David?
So I've got another opportunity for people, and that is that the Scottish Association for the Study of America is having their 20th annual conference in March the 2nd. The call for papers has just gone out. Proposals are due the 9th of January, and so people have a little bit of time to help think about putting together either an individual paper or a panel, but it's open to anybody who studies America in history, American studies, literature, media studies, cultural studies, any kind of thing. It's an organization that's been around now for 20 years. Lots of grad students, but also people who are a little bit longer in the tooth as well are welcome to come and share their research. And we've done a good job in recent years, SASA has, about having not only people from Scotland, but people from throughout the UK, from Europe, from the United States. I don't think we've had anyone from Asia yet or Africa, but we'll work on that. By all means, put together a proposal and come and see us in Edinburgh. So these are both opportunities, Frank, for people to come to Edinburgh and hang out with us.
Yes. Well, with regard to Edinburgh, it's the nicest city in the UK. With regard to hanging out with us, well, our listeners can reach their own judgments.
They've listened this long, Frank.
Yes. If you're still listening now, well, then you've only got yourselves to blame.
maybe they're hate listening to this. And then they're idiots that are listening to you every week. All right, Frank. Until next week.
All right. Cheers, David.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.